From London, it's the Wired.co.uk podcast, episode 53 for Friday, the 25th of November, 2011. On the show this week, it's bad news for Pakistan's potty mouths as the country's mobile phone networks may have to ban over 1,000 offensive, rude or downright daft words from use within text messages, so no bazongas for you. Someone's also been busy trying to fund a 10-story Tesla coil, and has Russia's troubled Phobos grunt probe finally been spotted with life signs? We'll find out that and more as we probe and prod our way through this week's Wired News. Hey there, I'm Nate Langson. I'm the editor of Wired.co.uk. Joining me, news editor Duncan Gear, of course.
Hello.
I didn't change my intro. Maybe next week. And of course, associate editor Olivia underscore Solon.
Hello.
How's everyone doing in our second year of being a podcasting team?
Excelente, monsieur.
Yeah, pretty good.
Good.
I'm pretty good.
Good. We we had our anniversary special show last week. If you didn't hear it, go and listen to it. It's free. No excuses. And we gave away an iPad. And at the end of the show this week, we're going to tell you who the winner was. We had hundreds of entries, so that was a lot of fun to judge, sort of. Anyway, we're going to get on with some news, I think, first. And the first bit of news we're going to get on with is that the Pakistani Telecommunication Authority has allegedly told the country's networks it has to block over 1,600 words. Some of these words are obviously offensive. The usual four-letter candidates are in there. But there are some rather bizarre...
There's some really weird stuff.
There's some really weird stuff in there. So on the 14th of November, mobile phone companies in the country were handed this giant list of words and a letter explaining that they had to block these words on their networks within 7 days or face the threat of legal action. And they also, operators also have to update the authority on the measures being taken every month.
So what's the reason for this? Is this a kind of moral crusade, basically?
We don't know. We don't know. And there are some of the words in here. I mean, the obvious swear words are in there. There are English words. I'm actually sure there are multiple languages.
There's Urdu and Punjab words, I think, as well.
Lots of words in there. But there are some really bizarre words that they have deemed inappropriate for use in text messages in Pakistan, along with the swear words. We've picked some favourites. Liv?
Yeah, well, I've selected flogging the dolphin, which I can kind of see with could be euphemistic. Glazed donut, kumquat, which I just thought was a fruit, but idiot, Kmart, and porch monkey.
What's a porch monkey?
Well, quite. I thought it may be a pet, a guard.
Yeah, we need to get Urban Dictionary out on some of these, I think.
Yeah, I mean, my favourite in the whole list was bazongas, but I think more appropriate is the list of totally benign words that have been deemed inappropriate for text message, such as harder, hostage, lesbian, tampon, testicle, and athlete's foot. What the hell is wrong with that? How am I supposed to tell my poor wife at home, you know, that my athlete's foot has been aching and, you know, it's going to make it harder to be a lesbian?
To take a hostage.
See, I think it's just going to force people to be more creative with language. So you're going to come up with even better descriptions and even more euphemistic ways of saying things.
Well, the problem is a lot of the euphemisms are banned as well. Third leg is in there, which I particularly liked, as well as putt pirate. And Tunnel of Love, all of those are in the list. But I think my absolute favourite was Cyber Slimer.
Wow.
What's a Cyber Slimer?
I don't think you want to know.
Really don't.
No, no idea. And no one in Pakistan will be able to find out by texting us. Do we have a text number? No, we don't.
No. We don't.
Well, you really can't find out then. Google that one. So yeah, pretty bad. I don't think we're actually going to see this get enforced, though. It's not actually been enacted yet. And there's been so much ridicule about this utterly bizarre approach to modern censorship on the internet and, of course, on Twitter over the last week or so, that it seems very, very difficult to stand by this list.
I can't. They're backpedaling a lot and they're saying that they're going to reduce the list enormously to make it more sensible.
Yeah.
To be honest, no list is going to be particularly sensible.
Well, quite. But if they're going to do it, then, you know, maybe make it a little bit less ridiculous.
Yeah. Fewer bazongas.
Fewer bazongas. Fewer innocuous words.
If you want to have a look at the full list, which does contain some very fruity words, I won't deny, go to wired.co.uk, search for Pakistan.
Yeah, Pakistan. It'll be at the top.
Pakistan words. And you will find a link to the full list. I heartily check it out. Heartily recommend you check it out. It's very, very funny. The Grunt Probe, Duncan, we've talked about this a couple of times over the last few weeks.
We have. Grunt Probe sounds like something that would be on that list, actually.
Russia's probing Grunt.
This is Russia's spaceship, which is going to Mars, and particularly the Phobos moon. It's called Phobos Grunt, because I think grunt means dirt or soil or something like that in Russian. And the mission is for this rocket to go up to Mars, orbit it for a bit, pop over to Phobos, pick up some dirt and come back.
And
I make it sound like it's just popping down the shops, yeah. But
it's very simple.
It's a bit more to it than that.
It's not brain surgery.
No, well, perhaps it is, because they've been having real difficulties getting it to go. Immediately after it launched on 9th of November, regular podcast listeners will know this because we've discussed this before, but Grunt suffered an immediate engine failure and couldn't get out of Earth's orbit. And so now it's kind of spinning around up at the very, very top of our atmosphere and in danger of falling into the ocean.
I feel really sorry for the Russians. They've never managed to get to Mars.
No. They've tried many, many times and they've never quite done it. But on the 22nd of November at, I think, about 8:30 in the evening, a tracking station in Perth in Australia managed to get in contact with the probe. And a spokesperson from the European Space Agency told us that they reckon it's because their 50-metre dish facility had recently been upgraded. And because of its geographical location, it was one of the very, very few in the world that has been able to send a command signal successfully to the probe.
But there's a little bit of time left that they've got to actually get this working before disaster strikes.
Yeah, absolutely. The probe's orbit is kind of decaying. It's going to run out of fuel, and there's a good chance it'll re-enter the Earth's atmosphere. But they have got a very, very slim window of opportunity to get it back on track to Mars, send the appropriate commands, and that's what they're working on now, working out how they can most efficiently do that and whether there's enough fuel still in the craft for it to go.
Here's hoping that in Pakistan they don't want to text about the probe re-entering the atmosphere, because that's never going to get through. Nope. Okay. Augmented reality contact lenses are apparently the future, or so says Olivia in about 30 seconds' time. Is that not true?
Well, potentially. A team of microengineers at the University of Washington and Aalto University in Finland have created the world's first computerized contact lens that currently has a very small display of 1 pixel.
So who are these star pupils who have come up with this?
I've already mentioned that they were the...
I just didn't want to waste that pun.
They were at the University of Washington and Aalto University in Finland.
Thanks for humouring me. But how does it work? I mean, and what's the point?
Well, it works by you have a contact lens and you have an antenna which harvests power transmitted from an external source. But this external source currently has to be 2 centimetres away from your eye.
Okay, so just before we go on, it's a contact lens in your eye and basically a battery 2 centimetres away from your eye.
Yes.
Strapped to your cheek or something.
That transmits the power, and that will make a tiny LED 1 pixel across light up.
Okay, can't do that much with a pixel, but this is early days,
I think. This is early days, and I guess the point is that augmented reality at the moment is never going to go anywhere if we constantly have to view everything through a mobile phone camera viewer. So we need to get to a point where it is in contact lenses, it is in glasses, and this is a really good step in that direction.
Also, you say you can't do that much with 1 pixel, but you could send Morse code with that. If you've got some operative in the field who doesn't mind having a battery strapped to his face, then yeah.
Well, currently it's only been strapped to a rabbit's face, so you need a rabbit who can read Morse code.
Yeah. But, you know, science is capable of great things.
I forgot to mention that it uses a Fresnel lens as well. So instead of, obviously, if you've got something stuck to the surface of your eye, you can hardly see or read it. But the Fresnel lens directs the image to the back of your retina, so you can see it without having the minimum focal length problem that you'd have otherwise.
So I guess the end game here is that we're talking about Terminator vision.
Yes, exactly.
And HUDs for everyday use.
Yes.
So you're walking down the street, you've got your contact lens in, and, you know, there's a map walking you to the nearest tube stop.
Precisely. Or you could have, you know, people's Twitter profiles appearing above their heads in the street. You could have, you know, directions to anything.
It's reviews. All these fancy sort of concepts we've seen in augmented reality apps, but actually useful because they're on all the time and you don't have to view the world through this tiny little window of a smartphone.
Yeah, exactly.
But we need to wait for the battery to be better so it doesn't have to be too centimeters close, and then I guess radio frequencies to actually get data into this contact lens. It's not easy to sort of send data into an eyeball.
No,
in my experience.
I guess we're talking at least a decade away for this then still.
Yeah, I reckon.
Let's keep our eyes on it. That was a good one, wasn't it?
No.
No. Okay. The EU court, Duncan, has ruled that content owners, i.e. people who make music and movies. Can't force web filters on ISPs, at least not in the UK.
Yes, we'll be brief on this because copyright stories are sometimes a little dull. But this is quite an important one because the European Court has basically said that your internet service provider can't, on a large scale, filter and block the use of copyright infringing sites.
So the last time that we talked about anything on this topic was when BT, I think, was told to block Newsbin, which was kind of like a file. It's not a file hosting service, is it? It's a news group directory.
No, it's basically it's a message board. Well, it's like sort of signposts to where copyrighted content is.
Okay, and does this mean that ISPs can't be told to block that site now?
Well, not quite, no. What they will still be able to, because that applies for one ISP and one website, and that's still possible because, you know, there's still legitimate applications for that when it comes to things like child pornography and stuff like that. You know, we do want to see blocked, or society does want to see blocked. But the thing is, what this bill does is it says that ISPs can't do that on a large scale. You can't, like content owners can't say to the ISP, you have to block all copyright infringing material. You can't do that. I mean, the important thing is here that that was never practical in the first place, but it's good that the courts have taken evidence, because there's precious little evidence in a lot of these arguments, and applied it and basically said, yeah, we recognise that's impossible. We recognise that's an unreasonable demand.
I think one of the problems to be seen here, though, is the fact that, you know, the difference between small scale and large scale can be seen as being quite a subjective decision.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, this is a kind of, you can't impose a kind of catch-all, you have to block all copyrighted material. The European Court said, for two reasons. One, because that's it's kind of pretty much impossible for an ISP to do that. But also that a filter like that would infringe on internet users' rights, the ones they have for privacy and for information protection.
So we can block the Pirate Bay from, say, TalkTalk, but we can't ban BitTorrent from all the five major ISPs in the country.
Yeah, pretty much.
It's the takeaway point. But also, that wasn't the other thing that we've had in the sort of world of traffic and internet regulations in the UK and Europe this week, because Ofcom has called for more transparency on traffic management, and this focuses squarely on net neutrality.
Yes, exactly. ISPs do a certain amount of traffic management on the internet. This is slowing down or accelerating the flow of data, often to get really crucial, critical kind of information through, often emergency calls and things like that get priority. And that obviously slows down some of the other services. But Ofcom wants ISPs to be very transparent about when and why they are doing these this kind of management. They don't want to see cases where they're giving priority to certain content providers for non-emergency reasons. And they want to have it laid out in a way that consumers can really simply understand. So they know why their servers might be slowing down when you're doing peer-to-peer file sharing.
Yeah, this would be a problem. This would be something that people will have run into if they have ever wondered why their internet gets slower, or particularly slower, maybe downloading stuff from BitTorrent in an evening. Because very often with the big ISPs, those technologies are throttled. The speed is throttled to allow more legitimate service, or at least what the ISP deems as a legitimate service, to pass through faster. That's often things like video on demand provided by
it's about company. It's about your mum and dad using iPlayer rather than you downloading Lost, basically. Yeah.
And this will basically make it clearer when you get throttled, and kind of, I think, goes a step towards preserving this net neutrality, which is to not have a fast lane that can be sold as a premium and a slow lane. It's, it's all the same speed, at least unless you're told otherwise and have a choice about it.
Yeah, I mean, at the moment, these kind of guidelines are only, they're kind of self-regulatory guidelines. They're meant to be taken up by the ISPs voluntarily. But if they don't comply, Ofcom's going to try and make it law that they release a basic level of information.
So are these guidelines in place now?
Yeah, they've been put in place now, and ISPs have to react as swiftly as possible.
Jolly good. Very good indeed. We're going to move into a ad break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about some mad science and 10-story high Tesla coils.
Wired magazine, now available to our print subscribers at no extra cost. For more information or to subscribe to the paper and iPad editions for just £2 per issue, go to wired.co.uk/iPad.
Duncan, massive Tesla coils, please. Info is required.
Is that another one that's in Pakistan's banned list?
Maybe.
Maybe. This is a chap called Greg Lay and his team of lightning enthusiasts from a group called Lightning on Demand. And they want to make an 80-meter bolt of lightning.
You know what's coming, don't you? I'm going to ask why.
Why? You're always asking why.
Here it comes. Why?
Why? Because when nature produces lightning, it can produce these huge discharges that only have about a fifth of the voltage per foot that the discharges that we build in our, that we create in a laboratory environment artificially require. So it's far, far more efficient. And what he wants to do is investigate that phenomenon, find out if we make this enormous 80-meter-long bolt of lightning, whether that's as efficient as natural lightning or whether that still remains inefficient. And the goal here is basically to kind of try and increase efficiencies in electro generation. You know what I'm trying to say.
Generating here. Electricity.
Yes,
basically,
exactly.
Nature is much more efficient at creating electricity than we are in
our
labs.
And we want to damn well know why.
Yeah. Liv, does this excite you, the size, the idea of this?
Well, I don't know who Greg is, but I'm just worried that he's some dude who just really likes lightning, like double rainbow man, and he's not a kind of scientist. I don't know. Is he, someone please explain to me, who is he, a serious researcher, or is he just like some dude who wants to make a massive Tesla coil?
Well, there's kind of a bit of a both. That's what he's doing to create this lightning bolt. He wants to build two 10-story high Tesla coils, whack them about 80 meters apart from each other, and create an electrical discharge that arcs overhead, covering the distance of about a football pitch. This is going to be a huge scale experiment. And yes, there is a certain level of whoa factor about the whole
thing.
And
surely a bit of health and safety factor as well.
Yeah, I expect so. But I mean, we're quite good at kind of using Faraday cages and so on to you know, keep the safety in these situations.
You know, you can have a lot of fun with a Tesla coil. I went to...
You've played one on a piano, haven't you?
This is where I'm going, yeah. I went to this sort of science-y event where they had these two musical Tesla coils. You can actually link them up to electric instruments and use the electrical impulses that come off the instruments to actually make the sort of the sparks that come off the Tesla coils vibrate in a particular frequency or something along those lines.
The same frequencies as the notes, essentially.
Yes, and what you can do with that is you can actually play a keyboard or a guitar and you can play music, and it just about resembles real songs. And if you want to hear it, I've got someone recorded me playing this on a mobile phone and uploaded it to YouTube.
What did you play? Was it the theme tune for The Littlest Hobo?
No, I played... what did I play? I played Newborn by Muse.
Oh, that's more appropriate. Should we hear it?
Do you want to hear it? Here it is. Yeah, so that was me playing Newborn on a musical Tesla coil about 2 years ago.
I would have preferred The Littlest Hobo theme tune.
I'm so glad someone showed up and videoed that, though, because I didn't go to do that. I was there to report on the damn thing, and someone said, "Does anyone play piano? I need someone to play piano." And I said, "I play."
Sure, shall we get back to what we were talking about? Yeah.
Yes.
Greg wants to solicit donations for this, because the problem is building 10-story high Tesla coils costs quite a bit of money. So he's taken the Kickstarter and is asking for about $350,000 to crowdfund this project, and what you get in return is maybe a bit of lightning trapped in some acetate, or perhaps the ability to a bit of lightning trapped in some acetate, not actual electricity, but the course that it cuts through the thing, so it looks like lightning cut out of plastic. They look quite cool. Or the chance to put an object into the strike field while it's happening, which is quite an honor.
Hang about, do we know how much that costs?
I can look it up.
Because there is a lot of stuff that I would love to see exploded. And, you know, we have some spare budget at the end of the year.
Yeah.
That sounds like a good use of Condé Nast pennies.
Surely this is just not going to get built.
I've got it here. If you if you pledge $10 or more, then you just get construction updates. If you pledge $25 or more, you get that. You get an action shot of it in operation. If you submit $75, you get tickets to a Lightning Foundry public performance, which is quite good going. So you get to see it in action. If you pledge $300, you get the electrical discharge trapped in an acrylic block.
That sounds a bit like, here's some air in a jar.
Yeah.
It's famous wind.
Exactly.
This wind blew over a queen. Here is some in a jar.
And then there's, sorry, I'm just sort of reading this while we're doing it. $595 will give you the Enthusiast Pack, which is an invite to transform an item of your choice with a multi-megawatt electrical discharge. You basically, they'll let you fire their half-ton high-energy capacitor bank into your item to help it achieve a high state of division, they say. So basically, you can just zap, mega-zap anything of your choice, and they'll give you slow-motion video of it happening.
$595, what's that, about 400 quid? Right, I'm not actually kidding.
And how much money have they raised so far?
So far, well, hang on, I was going to say, but if you pledge $9,600 or more, which is the most, the biggest one, and somebody has actually done this now, that gives you a bunch of things, but including the invitation to place an item of your choice inside the strike zone, a machine that intentionally uses the ambient fields for power, or just an item that kind of receives the electrical energy in an uncontrolled fashion and is inevitably consumed.
How does that differ from the previous option?
That was kind of... The last one lets you put it in when the Lightning Foundry thing is going zap. The first one is in a lab, they will zap some electricity into it.
So if you basically you get serious destruction with the top package.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We need to find something we can blow up.
We definitely do. They've managed $25,000 of their $350,000 target. With 16 days to go, so it's not looking great, but let's hope they can get some more money. You should contribute if you're listening to this.
They could really take on the will it blend guys with this, couldn't it? You know, will it explode? And they put consumer electronics devices into the middle of a giant Tesla coil. Anyway, I think we've talked about this long enough. My mind is racing with biological objects that we could blow up, and quite frankly the images in my head are quite terrifying. So
is one of them an egg?
Nicely laid there, Duncan. Yes. Like an egg. Dizzy is an egg. Liv?
Dizzy is an egg.
Remind me who Dizzy is.
Right. Well, hopefully most people remember the lovely egg-shaped video game character Dizzy, who starred in a fair few games from 1986 to 1992 on things like the ZX Spectrum, the Commodore 64, and Sega Mega Drive later. Well, he's back, and it's some very exciting news, as the website announced.
That's cracking news.
Yeah. I hope you're not yoking about that.
I am not yoking, and it is cracking news. Codemasters is remaking Dizzy, yay, but remaking it just for a smartphone. Boo. So iPhone, iPad, and Android users will be able to play Dizzy from the 9th of December.
And is it a new Dizzy, or is it what?
It's a remake of an old Dizzy game. Oh. And so I don't know if you remember Dizzy Prince of the Yolk Folk. Anyone? Anyone?
Didn't play that one myself.
Well, that one is going to be available on the 9th of December, so get cracking.
I'll tell you what else was cracking the other day. My wedding.
You got married?
Yes, my character did get married, Duncan. Thanks for asking. Do you know what's really weird? Marriage in Skyrim. You know the game we talked about last week?
I remember that game.
The week before. Getting married in Skyrim is one of the most bizarre experiences you can have without anything touching your body.
What happened?
Do you want to hear the story of my wedding day?
Yes, tell us about your wedding day.
Okay. We started after I put a particular piece of jewellery around my neck in Skyrim. It was a lovely sunny day, and a complete stranger came up to me and asked me if I was looking to get married, because this amulet thing that I was wearing sort of gives off the message to passers-by that you're looking for a wife and or husband. So...
and they're naked from the waist down.
Yeah. So, you know, me being a very much a sort of a Nord of the modern times, thought, okay, I'll marry a complete stranger. Decided to marry her.
So hang on, who's this lady that went up to you? What was her name?
Okay, so her name was Isolde, and I first saw her carrying kind of a basket of fruit, and I thought, oh, yeah, you look like the sort of woman that my character would want to marry. Sure, I'll become your life partner. So the day went by, and the very next day I had to arrive at a church, and I arrived at the church and found that my lovely bride-to-be was standing at the end of the church. So far, not that weird. You know, you can marry a total stranger in real life. Difference is, I arrived at my wedding in a full suit of armor with a female mercenary accompanying me down the aisle. Apparently, I couldn't think ahead to tell her to not come to my wedding, but there we go. Service starts, and you know, my wife says I do, and just as I was about to say I do and get given the rings, my wife starts walking away and leaves the church.
She's not that
Where
bothered.
Did she go?
Don't know. She just left, and I was left there fixed to my position because
awkward,
because I couldn't move, saying yes, fine, I'll marry this woman, and then sort of had to go out of the church and find where the hell she went.
Okay, where the hell did she go?
Well, I'm glad you asked, Liv, because what she actually did is went home, straight home, and locked the door. So I had to then use one of my many...
Is she just desperate for the loo or something like that? Is that what this is?
Maybe. But I was carrying like 100 lockpicks around, which I also took to the wedding, I might add, broke into my new wife's house to find out what she was playing at, and she made no mention of it and immediately asked, okay, where are we going to live?
Wow.
So I was like, whatever.
That's like a bit of a bunny boiler. I don't know.
Yeah.
I wouldn't stick with this if I were you.
Well, it's fine because I told her to move into my house. She immediately left without apologising for anything. I thought, right, that's enough. So I decided to steal some of her expensive items, as any newly married woman would do.
Yeah, yours now as well.
Yeah, I like to think so. And I went and found her at home. And this is where it gets really good. And by the way, this is already a very bizarre first day of marriage. You know, I had only known this woman for one day, so I suppose I had it coming. Went home and she had decided to set up a shop in my house and started selling random items and weapons out of my house, which I could then buy.
So she stole a load of your stuff and then tried to sell it.
Back
and you bought it all back?
No, I stole some of her stuff and sold it back to her.
Oh, okay.
And then
so
I bought
you're
some...
the real villain in this scenario.
I was just getting my own back. Do you know how weird that is? You know, I think when you make these video games, if you're going to go to the extent of giving someone the option to get married, I mean, at least let the woman remain at the wedding for the entire service.
Going slightly more seriously for a second, there was a commenter on, because you wrote this up in a blog post for our website. You can find it if you search for marriage on wired.co.uk. We don't write an awful lot of stories about
Skyrim marriage.
But one of the commenters pointed out that he sort of argued that there's no game that would be that wouldn't be improved by the removal of all romantic interaction options. Do you think that's true?
I think that's true in a certain extent. I mean, it gave me something very amusing to think about. I started making notes on while I was playing through my wedding, thinking this is the most bizarre thing that's ever happened to me in a game. I'm getting married. My wife has left mid-service. I had to break into her house to find her. Then I stole some of her stuff, sold it back to her, bought a mace from her, and went off and beat up some bandits. I mean, that's just so weird.
I mean, Maybe so far I'm not hearing any romantic interaction at all, Duncan.
She does give me some of the profits from her shop.
Okay.
Which now has paid back what
she
I paid for my
house. She sounds more like a business partner than a life partner.
She's a swine. That's what she is. And you know what, though?
Now you're bad-mouthing her on the Wired.co.uk podcast.
Well, the other thing is I have another wife in Fable 3.
I don't think this is going to last.
No.
No. I mean, she has no idea about this new woman. You know, I said in my story, I'm just going to delete the save, and that counts as divorce in my book. You know. Anyway, so I just wanted to point out the weirdness that has happened to me in Skyrim over the last week. Go and do the same thing and tell us if you have the same experience.
Yeah, and if you've had any other kind of weird experiences in video games lately, we want to hear about them. podcast@wired.co.uk. Send us an email.
But before you do that, we need to marry our news with a feature, which this week from Katie is about the company Naked Wines, which is founded by a chap called Rowan Gormley. The company specializes in sourcing wines from independent winemakers and is essentially crowdsourcing funding for winemakers. And we thought, that's an interesting idea. Let's find out more. So Katie did go and find out more.
So I'm here talking to Rowan from Naked Wines. Rowan, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
So first of all, please tell me a bit more about Naked Wines.
Well, we're a very new company. We're just coming up for 3 years old, but it's been remarkably successful, really. We will do about 20 million turnover this year, which is our third year. We've got over 200,000 customers. And the thing that makes us different to every other wine company is that we've managed to create a business model which is like a virtuous circle. Our customers fund us. We use that money to invest in winemakers. The winemakers can focus on what they love doing, which is making the wine taste delicious, and rather than selling it. So they give us preferential prices, and we pass those preferential prices back to our customers. So we try to, in effect, do the opposite of what the big supermarkets do, which is to use their buying power to squeeze suppliers. We're getting great wine at a great price for our customers by being nice to them.
So how does it work? Say I'm a vineyard owner in South Africa. I've only just started out, so very, very, well, not necessarily a young vineyard, but, you know, I've just come to it.
Yep.
I want to get my wine out there. So what would Naked Wines do for me?
We try to get involved before the wine is made. And what we do is we pay for the wine in advance, a third, a third, a third. So we pay a third at harvest time, a third at bottling, and a third when we collect it. So the winemaker, firstly, has got no working capital costs. Secondly, they've got no risk. The wine is all pre-sold. And it gives them it just means they can focus absolutely on what they're doing. So we're not interested in interest or dividends, or it's not a loan. We get repaid by the winemaker giving us their wine. In fact, it's kind of old-fashioned agricultural finance that died out about 500 years ago, and we've reinvented it for the internet age. But the principle's exactly the same. By giving them cash when they need it, and their banks won't give it to them, we get the wine back at preferential prices.
And you involve your customers right from the get-go, don't you?
We do. We involve them in the selection of the winemakers, in the selection of the wines, and in many cases in the actual pricing of the wine. So, for example, a few weeks ago, we got 50 of our customers into a room with 125 wines made by up-and-coming Argentinian winemakers. And we had three rounds of tasting. The customers picked the winner, and we gave them a £50,000 order. We put the wines on the site the next day, and we sold all £50,000 worth of wine within 16 hours to the rest of our customer base. So as a model, it's great for the winemakers because they can go from having a wine which they believe in to a firm order in 24 hours. And for the customers, they get to pick the wines they want, and they know that the wine that turns up is actually the wine they picked, which, there are a number of competitions where that's not necessarily the case.
But you're actually sending the wines out sometimes to customers to taste, and you call them, is it angels and,
yes.
and archangels you've got?
So we have customers, angels and archangels. Angels are people who help us by investing £20 a month with us, and we've got about 70,000 of those. And there's a smaller group of archangels, of which there are about 300. And for example, when we've commissioned a wine and it's ready to be bottled, we will send each of them a sample and get them to come back to the site and rate it. And if, for example, they come back and vote overwhelmingly that they really don't like the wine, then we've got a big problem, because if they don't like it, the rest of our customers won't buy it. So we have to sell it off in the local market. Sometimes they'll come back and say they think it's overpriced. Sometimes they'll come back and say they think it's sensational. But by giving the control of what we sell back to our customers, we get a great deal of customer loyalty, which means we don't have to waste our money selling to them, which means we can be more price competitive.
Now, you say that the company's been going for 3 years, and within that time it's obviously grown hugely. Has it largely grown through word of mouth?
A big chunk of it is through word of mouth. Very broadly, a third of all of our customers have come from personal recommendations. So if two people join us, generally one of the two brings a friend. But most of our new customer recruitment has come through partners. And we partner with people like Jamie Oliver, First Direct, BBC Good Food, and a number of other partners.
So what's coming up for you apart from a trip to San Francisco, which I'm incredibly jealous about?
Well, I'm pleased that you're jealous, because I'm really looking forward to it. What's coming up for us that's new? The first thing is we've got another 16 winemakers in the pipeline that we've been funding over the course of this year, and next year we'll be introducing them to the market, which is great. I mean, one of the slightly sad things about this business is the gap between commissioning a wine and actually having a product to sell is such a long time, but that's paying off, which is brilliant. The second thing is a bunch of people at Naked came along to me and said, we ought to do something in the mobile space, and somebody somewhere is going to invent the TripAdvisor for wine app, and it could be a real threat, so why don't we do it? And so we spun them out, and it's something that's my personal project. It's not a Naked Wines project. And these guys have set up. It's called Wine Demon. It's free. And it means that if you're standing in the middle of a supermarket aisle, you can get recommendations from your friends. If you're sitting in the middle of a restaurant trying to decide what the hell to order off the wine list, you can get recommendations from your friends. So if you're into wine and you'd like to share what you like and what you don't like with your real friends, give it a go.
And so is that available now?
It's available on the iStore now, and like I say, it's free.
And if people want to get more information about Naked Wines, where should they go?
Come to the website, nakedwines.com.
That's going to almost conclude our show, I guess, for this week. And but we do have one more thing to get to before we finish, which is to say that Paul Johnston of County Kildare has just won an iPad 2. Well done. He answered our question correctly in our anniversary episode last week. Give him a round of applause.
Woo!
Whee!
Goodness sake.
Well done, Paul.
Yeah. And we had hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of entries over the last 7 days for our sort of anniversary iPad competition. And thank you to everyone who entered. And particularly thank you to everyone who sent a nice little message in the email entering the competition. We had loads and loads of people wishing us a happy anniversary and how much they enjoyed the show. So if you're listening, you know who you are. We read all the emails, so you know that we appreciated that message. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
And yes, we're now into our second year of podcasting. And to celebrate, we're going to stop podcasting. Liv, tell people how they can get in touch with us.
You can follow us on Twitter, as ever. We're on @WiredUK. And we also have a Facebook page. Go to facebook.com/WiredUK.
We give some stuff away on there, actually, sometimes. We gave away some tickets to a 4K screening of Dr. Strangelove the other day.
You went along, didn't you?
I did. It was awesome. I mean, it was black and white, but it was black and
white.
Not
with one of the free tickets we were giving away, though.
No. I had a different ticket. But it was, yeah.
We also give away golden nuggets of chat, so get on there.
What?
Just little, you know, snippets of delightful pieces of information.
With things like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Go and do that. And yes, anyone else wants to email us, podcast@wired.co.uk. And I believe we will see you next week.
I think there's a good chance.
Bye.
Yeah, me too.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you, Katie. Oh, man, I'll tell you something. I really want a Sauvignon Blanc right now.
That's not something I've ever heard you say before.
Really?
No.
Really? I love the Sauvignon.
Do you?
Yeah.
I think you're more of an ale chap.
I get it on with the Sauvignon.